Hello and welcome to World Business Report from the BBC World Service. I'm Roger Hearing. And on this edition, as voting draws near, the last snapshot of the US economy suggests a bit of a blip in jobs growth. How far does the health of business affect voting choices for Americans? We'll be focusing on a key swing state, Georgia, and asking how important the issue of affordable housing is there. Also, Botswana gets a change of governing party after almost six decades, and the main reason seems to be the impact of a downturn in global demand for diamonds.
Having one government being in power for 58 years, they've been doing a fantastic job, but being able to change government for us, it means a lot.
Plus, whatever happened to Tupperware parties and the fifth birthday of Hello Kitty?
In terms of sales, Hello Kitty is still our strongest character.
And just how much money is there in the world? And if you've got thoughts on that or anything else you hear, you can contact us on WhatsApp or send a voice note if you want. It's +44 330 678 3033. That's +44 330 678 3033. Now, in the US, elections generally turn on the economy. And we now have the last economic data before Americans go to the polls. And it's a big one. Jobs. Non-farm payrolls is the official name. It's the number of new jobs. And the world's biggest economy added just 12,000 jobs last month. That's far below expectations and down from a revised 223,000 in September. The reason? Well, it seems to be a mixture of hurricanes and strikes. At the same time, the level of unemployment actually hasn't risen. And as we heard yesterday, consumer spending, in fact, is up. So what lesson could or should voters take from this? Joining me now is Chris Lowe, chief economist at FHN Financial in New York. Chris, thanks for being with us. First of all, I mean, this data, it comes out periodically, but this is really quite an important moment, isn't it?
It is, Roger. It really is. We're going into this election. The election day is next Tuesday. Of course, a lot of people have already voted. But this is the last big economic release before the big day.
And I suppose the question then is, how much does it tell us about the or tell voters, I suppose, who will be voting on Tuesday, about how the economy is doing? How should they interpret it?
Well, as you might expect, there are some political pundits who are jumping all over it. But honestly, we've known about this weather effect for ages. In terms of actual economic impact, job losses to things like storms are temporary. They have a minimal effect. And of course, people are already returning to work. Nevertheless, what it means is there's a question mark hanging over things as we go into the voting booth.
So if some voter came to you and said, Chris, okay, I want to vote on the basis of how the economy is doing. I mean, taking the long view, 6 months, years, how is the U.S. economy doing? What could you say?
It's strong. It's, we have GDP growth that is defying expectations. Certainly defying the Fed's forecast this year, it is quite a bit stronger. Job growth year to date, that's terrific. A very low unemployment rate. So, again, I think this one number doesn't tell you a whole lot.
But inflation, of course, is what you and I have talked about many, many times. And we know inflation is not where it was. But Americans don't seem to feel that in their pocketbooks. I mean, when you talk to people, voters, and they've been talked to a lot, of course, in recent weeks, they still say it's too much. We're paying out too much in our weekly shop. So why is that happening?
Well, I think the biggest thing is that wage growth, particularly the lowest paid workers, has slowed considerably this year. While inflation has come down, but it's coming down very gradually. In the meantime, people are acutely aware of how prices are after 3 years of high inflation. And, it's going to take, I think, some time to adjust to these new price levels.
Well, if that's the view from Main Street, what's the view from Wall Street, which is, of course, where you usually focus? Are the money men, if you like, the money men and women, of course, I should say, in America, are they betting on this recovering economy going much better in the months and years to come?
Well, certainly the stock market looks that way. We're at record highs on most of the equity indices. But the bond market is starting to get cold feet, starting to get nervous about potential rate cuts by the Fed, dialing back expectations, and that has caused interest rates to rise here, particularly long-term rates, including mortgage rates. Housing affordability is a big concern for Americans, and higher mortgage rates, well, that makes housing even less affordable.
And of course, in fact, as we were reflecting on yesterday, we've had some interesting earnings from the really big movers in the U.S. economy, the massive megalithic ones like Apple and Amazon, the tech giants, I suppose, really. And we've seen earnings, but we've seen a bit of a, well, they haven't had an easy ride despite having big profits.
No, it's a mixed bag for sure. Apple in particular, people are worried about sales prospects in Asia, China, especially. Amazon is doing well, but they're doing well partly because they are cutting costs where the business isn't working as well as they had hoped. Stock market liked that today, but they certainly didn't like the Apple results.
Thanks very much for taking us through all that, Chris. Chris Lowe, Chief Economist of FHN Financial in New York, giving us a sense of what we would say if we took the temperature of the economy as Americans prepare to go to the polls. But let's have a look at one particular state. Now, all this week, as you'll be aware if you've been listening, we've been looking at the all-important swing states. Now, those are the ones that could go for either Donald Trump or Kamala Harris, and whose votes in the Electoral College could tip the balance. In the run-up to the vote, we've been seeking out the key issues in these swing states. In Pennsylvania, looking at manufacturing, at the cost of living in Nevada, the automotive industry in Michigan, immigration in Arizona. Well, now we're in Georgia, and we're looking at the issue of affordable housing. Daniel McDonald from Georgia's radio station, WGA, reports now from the city of Athens.
This first song is about a house.
On a Sunday afternoon in late October, a small crowd gathered outside a modern mansion in the historic Pulaski Heights neighborhood of Athens, Georgia. The group of about 30 people walked, rode bikes, and pushed strollers up the short, dead-end street to watch the band Dog Person kick off historic Athens Porch Fest with a free concert in the mansion's driveway. Porch Fest celebrates a musical legacy that includes bands like the B-52s, R.E.M., Widespread Panic, and Neutral Milk Hotel. The annual festival presents Athens' next generation in concert throughout the seven historic neighborhoods where legends of the local scene lived, worked, and played Athens onto the musical map. This year's Porch Fest occurs weeks before a presidential election that will decide which candidate's plan will address a housing crisis that's putting affordable rent and homeownership beyond the reach of the many musicians who fill this city with sound. Drummer Patrick Ferguson has spent more than 30 years playing music in Athens.
So we're standing in the normal town neighborhood, and it is the birthplace of the Athens music scene because this was an affordable area with enormous crumbling Southern Gothic houses, and it's walkable to downtown where everybody had their jobs. And when it was cheap, we all lived here and made music here, and it's not that anymore.
Ferguson has watched Athens' population grow from roughly 87,000 people when he arrived in 1989 to almost 130,000 in 2024. Ferguson worries the people now moving to Athens for its high quality of life may be putting a strain on those who've depended on its low cost of living. The average sale price of a house in the Athens area is currently $430,000. That's almost double what it was in 2018. During the same six-year period, the median monthly cost of rental listings in Athens increased more than 70% to roughly $1,760 a month.
We need these prices to stop rising so people can take a break.
Spencer Fry is the executive director of the Athens Area Habitat for Humanity, a part of the international nonprofit dedicated to affordable housing. He's spent 25 years developing solutions to Athens' affordability crisis. He sees the opportunity for some good to come out of this year's presidential election. Trump promises to cut regulations that make housing more expensive, allow housing construction on some government-held lands, and create tax incentives that promote home ownership. Fry, a Democrat who represents Athens and Georgia's state legislature, clearly endorses Harris's proposals to give first-time homebuyers a $25,000 tax credit and to build more housing.
Just the idea that a candidate said she wanted to build 3 million new homes in the country. Now, that number would spur our economy. It would definitely put downward pressure on cost of ownership as well as rental.
Back at Porchfest, local band The Wild plays the porch of a clapboard house that was originally constructed for the workers who powered Athens' early 20th century mill economy. After their set, singer-guitarist Austin Emerson said he used to live in the house, but had to move out when the landlord tried to raise the rent. Emerson found a new place to live, but he has regrets.
We had to move further out of town. It was a lot easier to be involved in the music scene when I could just walk up the street and go to a gig. I don't know if I really appreciated that properly when I had it.
As this year's Porch Fest ends, festival goers must decide how they'll vote in the upcoming election, which may, in part, decide the extent to which music and musicians play into Athens' future.
Daniel McDonald reporting from Athens, Georgia. And if you can come with us on Business Matters at 1 o'clock GMT, you'll hear a lot more from Georgia and how it might vote in the election. But now let's turn our minds to Botswana, which has a new government and president. The party that's been in power for 58 years has been kicked out by voters in a shock result. They seem to be registering their anger over economic stagnation linked to a decline in the diamond trade on which the country depends. So what's the business community making of it? I got a reaction from Tamani Tote, who's the CEO of White Label Fragrances in Gaborone.
I'm one of the young people that voted a couple of days ago, and I just can't believe that I've been part of this change, you know. Having the one government being in power for 58 years, they've been doing a fantastic job, but being able to change government for us, it means a lot, and so I'm very excited about that. And as an entrepreneur, I think I welcome the new government that's coming in. They seem to have exciting things, especially for us entrepreneurs. And so, yeah, I'm just excited to see what is going to unfold.
Why do you think, then, Botswanans rejected the old party government? Why did they chuck out the incumbent?
I think because of what's currently happening economically, I think they just felt that maybe it was time for us to transition into a new government. And UDC, which is the current government that is coming in, felt like, you know, the best option for us.
Well, you say the current economic conditions. Just tell us what they are. What are the kind of things that have gone wrong, really?
It's not about it going wrong. I think it's just been something that has been happening over the years. And I think some of them, it is what our former president inherited from the previous leadership. So it's something that has been just going on for a long time. As you know, to be quite honest, we've been relying on diamonds quite for a very long time, and our economy has not been diversified.
So what you're saying is that the problem is the diamonds, perhaps the change in demand, the lack of demand in recent years.
Yeah.
That's had a knock-on effect onto, well, economic hardship for some Botswana.
Absolutely. We felt it economically in the country. There wasn't any money circulating in the country, and so it's hit us quite hard.
Well, of course, with your business, of course, being part of that, has your business suffered a bit economically as a result of the conditions?
I mean, yes, it has. I mean, you know, when there's no money that's so circulating in the economy, there's obviously a ripple effect. You don't get, you know, just to put it in simple terms, you don't get customers walking into your store, you know, your sales drop a bit. But we've definitely felt it. I mean, my business is a luxury business, you know, and so it's not a need. It's more of a want. And so we would feel it the most.
And what do you think needs to happen? Because you can't make people want diamonds, can you?
I think this is an opportunity for us all to work together as Botswana and not just rely on the government, but work as Botswana to see what we can do individually to try and push our economy forward.
Tamani Tote there in Gaborone. Well, diamonds are key for Botswana. It's Africa's leading diamond producer and the second largest in the world, just behind Russia. Gemstones account for around 80% of its exports, a third of its tax revenues, a quarter of its GDP. The new president, Duma Boko, says he wants a new sales agreement with the giant diamond seller De Beers as quickly as possible. And that could have major implications, not just for Botswana, but for the entire global diamond market. Paul Zamiski is a diamond expert based in New York. Joins me now. Paul, thanks for being with us. I mean, diamonds demand seems to have been the major problem. Why are people not wanting diamonds like they used to? And what's the effect on the market?
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's always good to be back. The last 3-4 years have been unprecedented for the diamond industry. We went from the lockdowns in 2020 to $7 trillion in economic stimulus in the U.S., which is the largest consumer of diamonds. And that just drove record diamond demand in 2021 that carried on to 2022. And now we're kind of on the other side of that as economies have opened back up. This, you know, stimulus has run its course, and people bought enough diamonds in 2021 and 2022 that they're spending their money on more experiential things.
Yeah. So how is this deal potentially between De Beers and the new Botswanan government going to affect things?
So they've been trying to work through this deal for over 3 years now. I think it's taken a lot longer than both sides would have liked. The pandemic definitely got in the middle and disrupted things. And now, with the election in Botswana, you know, perhaps that was something else that may have held it up a little bit. But the relationship between De Beers and the government of Botswana is probably one of the longest standing, most successful public-private relationships in mining, you know, across commodities, across industries. So there's a lot of history there. And I think, it's been a strong partnership, but I think they're having difficulty working out some of the final nuances.
We'll see how it all comes through. Paul, thanks for being with us. Paul Zimnisky there on the line from New York. You're with World Business Report from the BBC World Service. Now, let's talk about Tupperware. Do you remember Tupperware, the plastic food containers that dominated many kitchens across the world for many decades? Things you put your packed lunch in or your leftover cake. But alas, Tupperware's ability to keep its own freshness didn't work as well. Tupperware filed for bankruptcy last month, following a couple of years of the company's revenue dropping precipitously. The issues included anti-plastic sentiment and changes in how people shop. Well, Tupperware was a pioneer in selling via parties, a business model that's also been used by companies that sell makeup, jewellery and clothing. But in an age of online sales, where's the party at now? Stephanie Hughes from our US Partners Marketplace has been looking into it.
Yes, there's a party going on at Mrs. Betty Martin's house. It's a Tupperware party, and it's really fun.
That's from a 1961 Tupperware ad. The Mrs. Betty Martins of the world would invite their friends over for a demonstration of Tupperware's airtight storage. One seller was famous for filling a bowl with water or even grape juice, sealing the lid with that iconic burp, and then tossing it around the room.
It was an interesting new way of selling, and it was something that consumers responded well to.
Neil Saunders is a retail analyst with Global Data.
Tupperware does last, so once you've bought a set, you probably don't need to buy another one for 10 years, maybe more.
Compare that with skincare and makeup. When people are loyal to a product, they might refresh their supply on the regular for decades. Tammy Jones of Wake Forest, North Carolina, started holding Mary Kay parties more than 40 years ago. We talked recently over Zoom.
I see you. Do you see me?
I do not.
Okay, good.
Jones is a Mary Kay devotee. When she started selling, she was divorced and also working as a dental assistant. She did it just part-time for some extra cash.
I never made tons of money.
Jones says she usually earned $1,000 or $2,000 a year. Babson College marketing professor Lauren Biedelschmacher says the party plan business model works best for people who sell something because they love it.
If you're doing it as your livelihood to provide for your family, that could be problematic.
At least one company has faced legal action over problems sellers have faced. In 2021, the clothing company LuLaRoe settled a lawsuit with the Attorney General of Washington State. The lawsuit accused the company of misleading sellers by promising them big profits, when in reality, many were left with unsold merchandise and debt. As part of the settlement, LuLaRoe denied any wrongdoing. Lauren Biedelschmacher says a lot of people are now doing this on social media.
You just create an event, and because your friends have opted into this online event, the content that you post is going to show up in their feed.
She says part of the allure is you can only buy this way if you're invited.
Really appealing to our middle school senses of not wanting to get left out of the party.
Tupperware itself acknowledged in a bankruptcy filing that it's been late to the party when it comes to how people shop now. It noted the technology it's providing to its sellers hasn't been on par with what competitors use. That's one reason a lot of those sellers have quit. leaving the party entirely.
Stephanie Hughes leaving the party there. Now, you may have heard this week, a Russian court issued a big fine against Google for restricting Russian state media channels on YouTube. Now, when I say big, I mean big. They've been fined 2 undecillion rubles. Now, in dollar terms, that's a 2 followed by 34 zeros. Now, for a start, that's more than Google's entire worth, which is around $2 trillion. In fact, it's far greater than the world's total GDP, estimated by the IMF to be $110 trillion. More money, perhaps, than there actually is in the world. But how much money is there in the world? How do we even know? Let's bring in someone who's looked at this very question, Dr. Renaud Foucart, a senior lecturer at the Department of Economics at Lancaster University here in the UK. Dr. Foucart, thanks for being with us. First of all, how do you even begin to work out how much money there is in the world?
I guess the first way is to be as naive as possible. Just try to count the coins, the notes. And that you get that kind of data on the national banks, central banks, no? And you will get, for instance, in the UK, 84 billion. But then you look at that, you say, hey, no, that's not everything. People have money on bank accounts. And then you will get all around the world, if you take all the digital money we have, 50 trillion. But then you think, that's just money. The rich people, they don't put all their money on bank accounts. So you need to think in terms of wealth. Like you own a pot of gold, you own oil, but you own a business. If you put all of that together, you would get 400 trillion pounds. But this is also completely abstract, because if I decide to sell all the value of my business, it's worth nothing, because you need to have people actually owning it. So clearly, it's way, 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 way far from the fine that...
Well, I was going to say, because, of course, it depends what you value. I mean, you might look at a company and say, well, I think that company is worth X amount, or you might look at a nice painting and say it's worth that amount. So that gives it value, I suppose, but it's a very subjective thing.
It's a subjective thing, and it depends on the fact that people own it. So all the richest people in the world, think Jeff Bezos, he owns so much of Amazon. But if he started to sell massively his shares, people would start to panic. They would say, hey, why is he selling? Maybe it's worth less than we think. And the value would completely collapse. And so all those things are really, really subjective. If you look at all the subjects of the big debates in the US about the value of Donald Trump, he puts value to his brand, to his name, his family name. And in a way, it's true. But in another way, this is completely abstract. And so all those numbers are big figures, but that's not represent the cash that people have in hand. Yeah. And if you look at that fine, that Russian fine, it's in rubles. What happens if tomorrow the Russian economy collapses? Maybe it's worth nothing.
That's a good point, Dr. Foucart. So it's still, very confusing as to how much money there is in the world. Thanks for being with us here on World Business Report. Now, Hello Kitty is a phenomenon. The image of the cheerful white cartoon cat adorns merchandise from handbags to rice cookers, and it turned its creator Sanrio into a trillion yen firm. That's a market capitalization of more than $7 billion. Well, Hello Kitty is now 50 years old, but when its young chief executive, Tomo Kunitsuji, took over 4 years ago, the company was struggling to make a profit. He told my colleague, Mariko Oi, how he turned things around.
She's arguably one of Japan's best-loved creations. She's had a varied career. Animated television star, former Japanese tourism ambassador, and two-time visitor to the International Space Station. And according to Statista, as of 2021, Hello Kitty also ranks as the world's second highest grossing media franchise, behind Pokemon and ahead of US brands like Mickey Mouse and Star Wars. Hello Kitty was born when a little-known Japanese artist, Yuko Shimizu, put pen to paper and created a character titled Unknown White Cat.
It took a few attempts. When it was first designed, it was printed on a small purse released on sale, along with about 6 other different character products. However, Hello Kitty far outsold the others.
From her inception, the character was a success for Sanrio. It played on the Japanese culture of kawaii, which centered around the appeal of cuteness. According to a Forbes 2022 report, the character has reportedly generated $84.5 billion worldwide. Despite their popularity, the firm was struggling to be profitable after the most recent Hello Kitty boom in 2014 ended, until Tomo Kunitsuji became the chief executive. Now things are different. Here's Mr. Tsuji.
One of our business model is licensee business, which has become the core for our overseas strategy. For a company like ours, we get paid in royalties, and in return, our characters get the exposure in the market.
I'm about to get on a Hello Kitty cable car here in Singapore. It's just one of the collaborations Sandio has agreed with several high-profile global brands. The shoe manufacturer Crocs recently added a line of Hello Kitty designs, and Starbucks used to sell Hello Kitty drinks.
In terms of sales, Hello Kitty is still our strongest character, and the two big surges in our sales throughout our history were both created by Hello Kitty.
The revamping strategy has paid off, transforming it into a $7 billion house of characters.
Mariko Oi, looking at Hello Kitty, that very iconic brand. Now, let me tell you a little story about that. I have a daughter who, back when she was much younger, had an amazing Hello Kitty doll. It was with her the whole time. We went on a family holiday, in fact, to Jordan, Middle East, took Hello Kitty with us. We then crossed the Jordan Valley and moved up into Israel and the West Bank. Unfortunately, we left Hello Kitty behind. I can't tell you how difficult that was. We then had to cross back an international border in order to get this highly desired Hello Kitty doll. So let me tell you, the power of Hello Kitty is really quite something. And it certainly cost us a lot of time and effort, but it was all worth it. Anyway, that's it from this effort that has been World Business Report. Thanks very much for listening from me and all the rest of the team. Bye-bye.